earnings multiple that XYZ commanded before the recap. After all, the greatly increased debt load raises the risk to investors in XYZ common stock. And since investors like to get paid for taking on additional risk, the stub stock should trade at a lower earnings multiple. How low? It's no science, but a new price-earnings ratio of 8 or 9 wouldn't seem unreasonable. This would leave the stub stock trading at around $10 for a PE of 8.33, resulting in a total value for the recap package of about $40 per share, $30 in debt plus a $10 stub, versus the original pre-recap price of $36. Does this result make sense? XYZ's assets haven't changed. The sales and earnings power of the business are the same. Where does the $4 gain to shareholders come from anyway? Isn't this recap stuff just a bunch of smoke and mirrors? You know, what they call financial engineering? Well, not really. The trick is in the taxes. Before the recap, of the $5 in pre-tax earnings, $3 went to shareholders in the form of earnings, and $2 went to Uncle Sam in the form of taxes. After the recap, $3 goes to shareholders in the form of interest payments on the newly distributed bonds, and an additional $1.20 goes to shareholders in the form of earnings on the stub stock. That's a total of $4.20 going to shareholders versus just $3 before the recap. Uncle Sam's cut, as a result of the recap, is just 80 cents, down from $2 before the recap took place. No smoke and mirrors. Leveraging the balance sheet, but not over-leveraging it, just turns out to be a more tax-effective way to distribute earnings to shareholders, and that's definitely worth something. Of course, you're not going to hear about the recap until after it's already been announced in the papers. So much of the $4 gain created by the recapitalization transaction will already be reflected in XYZ's stock price before you get a chance to invest. Still, recaps can provide ample opportunity to profit. For instance, in recap situations where debt or preferred securities are distributed directly to shareholders, the profit opportunities can be similar to those available through investing in merger securities. Investors who owned the common stock of XYZ generally don't want the company's debt and preferred securities. Consequently, shortly after being distributed, these newly issued securities are often sold indiscriminately. But you know this story already. And anyway, it's the other part of the recap story that can get really exciting. That part involves investing in the stub stock, the equity stake that remains after the company has been recapitalized. This is where you can make the big money. Essentially, investing in a stub stock is just like investing in the equity portion of a publicly traded leveraged buyout. Many leveraged buyouts have returned 5 or 10 times the original equity investment, and several stub stocks have produced similarly spectacular returns. Sure, leveraged buyouts have been known to fail, and likewise, the value of some stub stocks has vaporized. But the payoffs on the ones that do work can more than make up for a few losers. In fact, there is almost no other area of the stock market where research can be rewarded as quickly and as generously as in the careful analysis of stub stocks. Why can stub stock investing be so lucrative? The answer is pretty straightforward. It's all in the numbers. While we have previously discussed the various benefits and risks of investing in leveraged companies, reviewing the math, once again, can only help to highlight the opportunity. In our example, let's assume that XYZ's pre-tax earnings improve 20%, increasing from $5 per share to $6. Assuming no recap, a 40% tax rate will take after-tax earnings to $3.60 per share. At a multiple of 12 times earnings, XYZ stock will move from $36 to $43.20 per share, for an increase of 20%. Assuming XYZ goes through with the recap, the story looks a little different. Using the assumed increase in pre-tax earnings to $6, and subtracting the $3 of interest payable on the bonds distributed in the recapitalization, we come out with $3 in taxable income. After paying 40% in taxes, the after-tax earnings of XYZ's stub stock work out to $1.80 per share. Using the same multiple as earlier, 8.33 times earnings, XYZ's stub stock is now worth $15, up 50% from the original stub price of $10. Taking it a step further, now that XYZ's pre-tax earnings exceed its interest expense even more comfortably than in the original scenario, the stock may be viewed as less risky. A price-earnings ratio of 10 might now seem reasonable. Therefore, the stub stock could actually trade to $18 per share, 10 times $1.80 in earnings, or an 80% gain from the original $10 price. Once again, this potential 80% gain was made possible by a relatively modest 20% increase in pre-tax earnings. As you can imagine, when they work, leveraged recaps can be both fun and profitable. Unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, nowadays investors don't have many opportunities to invest in the stub stocks of recapitalized companies. For the moment, at least, recaps are out of fashion. However, if the idea of investing in leveraged equities still excites you, I do have two suggestions. First, investing in leveraged spin-offs can give you every bit as much bang for your buck as investing in stub stocks. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with looking very closely at this area, except that we've already covered it. The second suggestion is what I promised you at the start of the chapter, a way to use what you've learned about recaps to your advantage. Since, for the most part, companies are no longer pursuing the recap route themselves, it's a way for you to create your own recap, sort of. But before we get to that, let's go back to the heyday of recaps, the mid-1980s, to see how one works in real life. Case study: FMC Corporation. In February 1986, FMC Corporation, a defense contractor and manufacturer of chemicals and machinery, announced plans to pursue a major recapitalization. FMC's move was prompted by concerns that the company was being stalked by a hostile suitor. After reviewing the available alternatives, FMC's board of directors decided that a recap was the best way to fend off a potential takeover. It was hoped that the recap would both boost the company's stock price and give the company's management and employees a greater equity stake in the ongoing enterprise. If the recap was successful, a hostile bidder would be deterred and management and employees would retain control over their own destiny. Under the plan, for each share held, FMC shareholders were to receive a cash distribution of $70, as well as one new share in the recapitalized company. In lieu of the cash payment, management shareholders and shareholders in the company's employee stock plan were to receive additional shares in the recapitalized company. So instead of receiving $70 in cash, management shareholders would receive an additional 4 2/3 shares of the recapitalized company. This meant that management would receive a total of 5 2/3 shares of the recapitalized stub stock for each FMC share held before the recap. After the plan was completed, insider ownership in FMC would increase from 19% to over 40% of the company's shares. At first, the plan appeared to have the desired effect. FMC stock, which had been trading at around $70 before takeover rumors began circling around the company, moved to approximately $85 per share after the recapitalization plan was announced. This implied that the market was placing a value of approximately $15 on the stub stock that would remain after the $70 distribution was made to outside shareholders. Takeover rumors did not abate, however, and the stock continued to climb into the mid-90s over the next 6 weeks. In early April, Ivan Boesky, the infamous takeover trader and sometime corporate raider, announced that he had purchased a 7.5% stake in FMC's shares outstanding. He announced that, in his opinion, the recapitalization plan was too generous to management shareholders, and that he planned to oppose the plan when it came up for a shareholder vote the following month. Partially in response to Boesky's opposition to the plan, as well as to the significant increase in the company's stock price, the company announced an amendment to the plan several weeks later. Citing current economic and market conditions which reflect declining interest rates and strong market interest in the plan, FMC increased the amount of the cash distribution to $80 per share. Despite the increased payment to outside holders, the number of stub shares that management and employees were to receive was to remain the same as originally proposed under the initial plan. A proxy statement describing the revised recapitalization plan was filed with the SEC in early May 1986, with a shareholder vote scheduled for later that month. Since I knew that stub stocks can often produce spectacular gains, I read the proxy material with much interest. What caught my eye was a prominent part of the proxy entitled Certain Projections. In this section, management had laid out its best guess as to what FMC's income statement, cash flow, and balance sheet would look like for the next 8 years. As I've mentioned before, I take management projections with a grain of salt. Long-range projections are even more suspect. But in this case, I paid a little more attention. After all, management wasn't taking any cash from the recapitalization. They were foregoing an $80 cash dividend in exchange for a larger equity stake in the recapitalized company. Not only that, but more than ever, FMC's managers would be betting their fortunes and careers on the success of the company going forward. According to the projections, in just 3 years, FMC was expected to earn $3.75 per share, with after-tax free cash flow of approximately $4.75 per share. By that time, the company's pre-tax earnings were anticipated to exceed its annual interest expense by a ratio of almost 2 to 1. And at a multiple of perhaps 10 times free cash flow, the stub stock could be approaching $50 per share. With FMC trading at approximately $97 per share, and assuming the recapitalization was successful, this meant that I could create the stub stock at a price of $17. $97 stock price, less the $80 cash distribution. If FMC's projections came close to being correct, this would turn out to be a real bargain. What happened? The stock hit $40 about a year after the recap was completed, and briefly touched $60 several months later just before the crash in October 1987. However, to prove the old adage that leverage works both ways, i.e. big upside potential and big downside risk, the stock fell all the way back to $25 in the aftermath of the crash before settling in at around $35. What happened to me? I missed all the action. For some reason that I can't recall, I sold my position in FMC at about $26 several months after the recapitalization was completed. Maybe I wasn't enamored with the quality of FMC's businesses and just followed my own advice by trading the bad ones. Or maybe I got up on the wrong side of the bed the day I decided to sell. Regardless, I was kind of glad to miss out on that kind of fun. Oh yes, I almost forgot. As it turned out, Boesky had acquired his original position in FMC based on inside information. The company later sued him for forcing the $10 dividend increase under the recap plan. After admitting to many instances of securities fraud, including a rather sophisticated scheme where he exchanged suitcases loaded with cash for inside tips, Boesky was sentenced to several years in prison. In the end, Boesky did his time. And if you've read this far, so have you. That's why I'm finally going to tell you how to put your knowledge of stub stocks and their explosive profit potential to good use. Leaps. Long-term equity anticipation securities. As I mentioned earlier, there is a way to create your own version of a stub stock. Simply by choosing among the hundreds of available leaps, you can create an investment situation that has many of the risk-reward characteristics of an investment in the leveraged equity of a recapitalized company. The term LEAPS is nothing more than an acronym for a long-term option contract, long-term equity anticipation security. If you're thinking, that's great, but what's an option? Don't sweat it too much. While there are two kinds of options, puts and calls, we'll only be talking about the calls. Further, we'll only be talking about the kind of calls that trade on a national securities exchange, listed calls. All right, so that didn't make you feel any better. But listen on anyway. There's big money at stake. A call is merely the right, but not the obligation, to buy a stock at a specified price for a limited period of time. So a June call to buy IBM at $140 per share gives the owner of the call the right to buy IBM at a price of $140 per share until the call expires in June. The third Friday of each month is considered the expiration date for listed options. If at the expiration date, IBM stock is trading at $148, the call would be worth $8. This is because the right to buy stock at $140, when the stock can be immediately resold for $148, is worth $8. If, on the other hand, IBM stock is trading at only $135 on the call's expiration date, then the call expires worthless. This is because the right to buy stock at $140, usually referred to as the strike or exercise price, isn't worth anything if everyone can just go out into the marketplace and purchase the same stock for $135. Well, that just about covers the basics. Except there's one more step. Pretty much whenever the stock market is open, the options market is also open. There aren't listed options available for every stock that trades, but options do trade on thousands of the largest companies. Therefore, if a stock has listed calls, you can usually buy and sell them during market hours up until their respective expiration date. In our example, the June $140 calls to buy IBM stock were trading for months prior to their June expiration. We've already discussed what the call would be worth on its expiration date. The question is, what is the fair value of the call before the expiration date? To be more specific, how much should you pay for the calls if you buy them in April, approximately 2 months before they expire? While you don't really have to figure out the correct pricing for a call, it is good to understand where the price comes from. Note, for purposes of our discussion, the effect of dividends can be ignored. Let's assume that IBM is trading at $148 in April, 2 months prior to June expiration. We already know that, if it were the third Friday in June, these IBM calls would be worth $8. In April, however, these calls are worth more than $8. They're more likely to be trading closer to $11.375. Why? There are really two reasons. First, the owner of the calls doesn't have to lay out $140 for another 2 months, yet he is entitled to all of the stock's appreciation until June. Think about it. If IBM stock were to gain another $10 per share by June expiration, then IBM would be trading at $158. The owner of stock since April would have a gain of $10 on his $148 investment. On the other hand, if the IBM June $140 calls could be purchased for only $8 in April, then the owner of an $8 call option would make $10 in the same 2 month period. That's because, on the expiration date, the owner of the call could purchase stock at $140 and sell it for $158. After subtracting the $8 initial cost, the profit would be $10. This result wouldn't be fair. After all, the owner of the stock laid out an additional $140 for the same amount of profit. The owner of the call received the upside in IBM stock without having to invest an additional $140. To compensate for this, the amount of interest that could have been earned on the $140 for the 2 months until expiration should be reflected in the price of the call. It is. Assuming a 6% interest rate, the interest earned on $140 would be approximately $1.40 per share. So in addition to what's known as the intrinsic value of the call, the amount by which the call is already in the money, in our example, the difference between the market price for IBM of $148 and the exercise price of the call of $140 or $8, an imputed interest rate for the amount of money the call buyer didn't have to lay out for the 2 months is also included in the call price. That's how we move from a call price of $8, the intrinsic value of the call, to approximately $9.40, the value of the call including the interest on the $140 the buyer of the call didn't have to lay out. But I said the call should trade at approximately $11.375. What accounts for the nearly $2 difference between the $9.40 we already figured and the actual price of $11.375? Clearly, there has to be another benefit to owning calls. And there is. The buyer of the call can only lose the amount of money invested in the call. While this doesn't sound all that great, when you compare it to owning the common stock of IBM, it is. This is because at the June expiration date, if IBM stock falls to $140 per share, the owner of the call loses his original investment of $11.375. If IBM stock falls to $130 per share, the owner of the call loses the same $11.375. At $120 per share, or even $80 per share, the call owner only loses $11.375. Sounding better yet? It's pretty obvious what happens to the poor owner of IBM stock in this scenario. At a price of $140 at the June expiration date, the IBM holder is down $8 from his April purchase price of $148. At a price of $130 in June, he's out $18. If IBM's at $120, he's out $28. And at a price of $80, the loss really gets ugly. He's out $68 per share. See, there is an added benefit to owning the calls. It's the benefit of not losing any more money after the stock falls below the strike or exercise price of $140 per share. What's that worth? Well, in this case, it's probably worth about $2. So if you pay the $2 in protection money as part of the purchase price of the calls, then your cost of $9.40 moves closer to the $11.375 price we talked about before. The $2 cost for assuming the risk below $140 is actually the same as the cost of the put option. But I said we'd only talk about calls, so not another word. The bottom line is that buying calls is like borrowing money to buy stock, but with protection. The price of the call includes your borrowing costs and the cost of your protection. So you're not getting anything for free, but you are leveraging your bet on the future performance of a particular stock. You are also limiting the amount you can lose on the bet to the price of the call. So, getting back to the main point, the whole create your own recap thing, owning a call isn't too much different from owning a stub stock. With a stub stock, you have a leveraged bet on the future of a company, and you can only lose the amount invested in the stub. In our original example, where the company with a $36 stock recapitalized by distributing $30 to its shareholders, the result was a leveraged stub that magnified changes in the value of the underlying company. There, a relatively modest 20% increase in earnings resulted, in one scenario, in an 80% gain in the stub stock's price. On the other hand, if the company declared bankruptcy, an owner of the stub stock was only at risk for the amount invested in the stub, not for the $30 of debt taken on by the company to complete the recapitalization. Despite the similarity between the leverage characteristics of stub stocks and options, the two types of securities differ in one important way. Options have a limited life. They only have value until their expiration date. Stub stocks are common stocks, so, in some sense, they are really like calls without an expiration date, although the stub stock may become worthless as a result of a bankruptcy proceeding. It is this unlimited life that makes stub stocks so attractive. That's why buying LEAPS, which are merely long-term options, can be an attractive way to emulate a stub stock investment. While LEAPS don't have an unlimited life like stub stocks, they can usually be purchased up to 2.5 years before they expire. This often gives ample opportunity for the stock market to recognize the results from an extraordinary corporate change, like a spin-off or restructuring, or a turnaround in fundamentals, like an earnings gain or the resolution of an isolated or one-time problem. Additionally, 2.5 years is often enough time for many just plain cheap stocks either to be discovered or to regain popularity. Since current tax law favors holding investments for more than 1 year, buying LEAPS is also a way to receive long-term capital gains treatment while receiving the leverage benefits of an option investment. In some ways, though, LEAPS can't duplicate the dynamics of a well-planned recap. In a recap, management and employees can be incentivized using the new stub stock. Given the tremendous upside of stub stocks, this can be a powerful way to unleash the forces of management and employee stock ownership in an organization. Also, a recapitalized company has the immediate benefit from the tax advantages of a leveraged balance sheet. Obviously, buying LEAPS doesn't affect the tax status of a corporation. However, because there is an implied interest cost factored into the price of the LEAPS, interest expense does get included in the LEAPS holder's tax basis. On the other hand, there is one huge advantage that LEAPS have over stub stocks. You can trade LEAPS on hundreds of companies, while the list of available stub stocks is limited to the number of companies that choose to recapitalize. Even in the 1980s, this list covered only a select few companies at any one time. The fact that there are so many LEAPS to choose from, and that you, rather than a company's management, get to choose which stocks would make the best leveraged or stub-like investments, should make LEAPS a very useful investment alternative. While stub stock opportunities are generally easy to spot, as there is usually an announced recapitalization transaction, investments in LEAPS come about in a different way. In most cases, your decision to invest in LEAPS will simply be a byproduct of your ongoing research efforts. Before you even begin thinking about LEAPS, a special situation or an undervalued stock will catch your attention as an attractive investment in its own right. Only after an investment passes the first hurdle will you bother to check whether a chosen investment situation has LEAPS available for trading. At the very least, being able to compare the risk-reward of a stock with the opportunities available through an investment in the related LEAPS will provide you with another good investment choice. How much money can you make investing in LEAPS? Plenty. But don't take my word for it. Seeing is believing. So let's take a peek at what the potent 1-2 punch of LEAPS leverage and extended timing can do to magnify the returns of good investment ideas in the real world. Case study: Wells Fargo LEAPS. Remember what I told you about stealing other people's ideas? You know, it's a big world out there. You can't cover everything yourself. You still have to do your own homework. Well, in the next chapter, we'll get around to discussing where to steal from, the short list of publications, newsletters, and money managers that I've found to be the most valuable sources of good ideas. However, before we get to that, let's take a look at a situation that I stole from one of my favorite investment newsletters, Outstanding Investor Digest, OID. After reading an incredibly compelling investment case for investing in Wells Fargo stock outlined in the newsletter, I concluded this was an idea I had to steal. Only I liked it so much that I decided to leverage my returns through investing in the company's LEAPS. In this case, because of the added element of protection that the LEAPS afforded, I was able to make a great risk-reward situation even better. In December 1992, I read an interview conducted by OID with an investment manager at Lehman Brothers who was previously unknown to me, Bruce Berkowitz. The fact that I had no idea who he was didn't matter. The logic and clarity of the investment case he made for Wells Fargo stock was overwhelming on its own. At that time, Wells Fargo, a large California-based bank, was trading at around $77 per share. California was in the middle of the worst real estate recession since the 1930s. Wells Fargo had by far the largest concentration of commercial real estate loans of any bank in California. According to Berkowitz, Bank America, Wells's largest competitor in California, had commercial real estate loans on its balance sheet equal to only $48 per share. Its stock price was approximately $47 per share. Wells Fargo, on the other hand, had commercial real estate loans totaling about $249 per share, as compared to a stock price of about $77. Further, Wells had taken a loss provision, reserves that anticipate future loan losses, of $27 per share the previous year, wiping out almost all of its earnings. In just the first 9 months of 1992, Wells had provisioned for an additional $18 per share of losses. Many investors questioned whether Wells Fargo would survive the real estate downturn. Berkowitz's investment case was fairly simple. If you excluded the loss provisions, Wells, adjusting for cash earnings and one-time expenses, was already earning nearly $36 per share before taxes. If the real estate environment ever recovered to a more normalized level, loan loss provisions, based on past experience, would probably fall to approximately $6 per share on an annualized basis. This would translate to normalized pre-tax earnings of $30 per share, or $18 per share in earnings on an after-tax basis, assuming a 40% tax rate. At a price of 9 or 10 times earnings, Wells Fargo could be trading at $160 to $180 per share, versus its then current price of $77. The question wasn't how Wells Fargo could increase its earnings power to reach $18 per share in after-tax earnings. Wells was already earning that kind of money. But for the effect of the extraordinary loan loss provisions. According to Berkowitz, the real question was, what was the right way to look at the loan loss provisions and how bad they were? Berkowitz explained that the financial position of Wells Fargo was actually quite strong. Even the loans that Wells had already classified on its balance sheet as non-performing were actually earning interest for the bank. Although, to be conservative, this interest was not included in the bank's reported earnings. Non-performing loans are loans that are in some way substandard. Either loans that are not paying any interest, not paying the full interest obligation, or loans where it is merely anticipated that future interest charges and principal payments might not be met on a timely basis. Far from being worthless, these non-performing loans, which equaled approximately 6% of Wells's total loan portfolio, still had a cash yield of 6.2%. This meant that at a time when the prime rate, the interest rate that the bank's best customers paid on their loans, was 6%, and the cost of Wells's money, the rate Wells paid its depositors, was only around 3%. The questionable part of Wells's loan portfolio was still earning a very respectable cash return of over 6%. In other words, if Wells was still able to collect such large interest payments from these non-performing loans, maybe they weren't so terrible after all. At least, it made sense that a good portion of the face value of the non-performing loan's value would ultimately be recovered. In fact, according to Berkowitz, Wells was being so conservative about classifying its loans that 50% of those loans it had classified as non-performing were still up to date on all required interest and principal payments. Further, for purposes of reporting income and taking reserves against its balance sheet, Wells had already assumed the worst for its portfolio of non-performing loans. Including the hefty loss provisions of the previous 2 years, reserves for future loan losses stood at 5% of the bank's total loan portfolio. Since currently only 6% of Wells's loans were classified as non-performing, remember, these loans were far from a total loss. Before this 5% reserve would become inadequate, either almost all of the non-performing loans would have to become completely worthless, or the loans that were now considered performing would have to take a dramatic turn for the worse. Given the level of Wells's apparent conservatism, the way Berkowitz had it figured, both seemed highly unlikely. Two other points clinched the deal for me. The first was a comparison made in the OID piece between Wells Fargo and Bank America. According to most investors, Bank America's stock was the much more conservative investment of the two banks. As it turned out, however, although Wells did have a much bigger exposure to the California real estate market, and therefore more non-performing loans, it had already reserved for much bigger losses than Bank America. Despite these reserves, Wells Fargo still had higher capital ratios than Bank America, tangible equity to total assets, etc., even after adjusting for its riskier asset profile. This was just another sign that Wells wasn't in as bad shape as the stock market apparently believed. The second point was even more persuasive. With all of the non-performing loans, loss reserves, and actual loan losses, Wells Fargo still hadn't shown a loss for any year in its 140-year history. Most industrial companies don't have anywhere near that level of predictability to their earnings. In what many considered to be the worst real estate environment for California in over 50 years, Wells still had managed to eke out a profit in 1991. This indicated to me that Wells was a good bet to get through this difficult period, and that a multiple of 9 or 10 times normalized earnings, an earnings multiple substantially below most industrial companies, was a reasonable and attainable goal for its stock. The bottom line was, if Wells survived the current real estate downturn, and its annual loss provisions returned to normalized levels, the stock looked like a potential double. While the whole analysis made tremendous sense, I did have some nagging concerns. What did I know about the California real estate market? What if the environment in California turned dramatically worse? It appeared as though Wells could weather a pretty severe storm, but what if the once-in-50-years rain turned into an unprecedented monsoon? Of course, I never invest in situations with complete certainty anyway. Situations that make sense and offer attractive returns given the risks involved, that's all I can really ask for. But still, a bank is a funny animal. You never really know exactly what makes up its loan portfolio. The financial statements only give a very general overview of the bank's assets. Then again, Wells did offer some comfort in this area. Between its reserves, the quality of its non-performing loans, and especially its ability to earn huge returns each year, Wells seemed to have a huge cushion to cover any future loan losses. Nevertheless, there was still a chance, no matter how slight, that the bank's portfolio of real estate loans could spoil what looked like a great investment. That's why investing in the LEAPS seemed to make such good sense. Although the stock looked like an outstanding investment, combining a great chance for a double with a remote possibility of disaster, the LEAPS looked even better. At that time, December 1992, I could buy Wells Fargo LEAPS that gave me the right to buy stock at $80 per share until January 1995, more than 2 years away. By the time those 2 years were up, I figured it would be pretty clear whether or not Wells had survived the California real estate crisis. If things were looking up by then, there was an excellent chance that Wells's earning power would be reflected in its stock price. A price of $160 or more didn't seem outlandish. On the other hand, if the severe downturn turned into a real estate debacle, the stock could trade substantially below $80. And in the absolute worst case, there would be a government takeover of the bank with the stockholders wiped out. With that outlook, and at a price of $14, the January 1995 calls, referred to as LEAPS because of their long duration, to buy Wells Fargo stock at $80 per share looked pretty enticing. These LEAPS would give me the right to buy Wells Fargo stock at $80 per share until they expired in January 1995. If Wells were trading at $160 by then, these LEAPS would skyrocket to $80, because I could buy Wells at $80 and immediately sell it for $160. On an investment of $14, this would mean a profit of $66, or a gain representing almost 5 times my original investment. If Wells crashed and burned, I would be out just the $14. So, one way to look at an investment in the LEAPS was, here was a way to set up a risk-reward ratio of 1 down to almost 5 up. The stock, if you looked at this extreme scenario, Wells was either going to make it with flying colors or not make it at all, did not offer as good of a risk-reward. At a price of $77 per share, if the stock hit $160, stockholders would make a little more than $80. If Wells didn't make it, a stockholder could lose almost $80. This was a bet of 1 up to 1 down. Since the fact situation outlined in the OID interview seemed to check out, I was actually pretty excited about the upside prospects for Wells. Right or wrong, my assessment of the chances for the extreme downside case were below 5%. While this analysis made both the stock and the leaps look like terrific investment opportunities, the leaps, under this scenario, provided the better risk-reward. A simpler case for the leaps went this way. If I liked Wells Fargo so much, why couldn't I just leverage up my bet by borrowing money to buy the stock? Well, that's just what I did by buying the leaps, only I got a really great deal. Here's how it went. I could borrow the entire purchase price of Wells stock in December 1992. The only money I had to lay out up front was for the interest charges on my borrowing. This would represent interest for the next 25 months, taking me to January 1995. The catch was that the interest charges wouldn't be low, though the rates wouldn't be nearly as high as the rates on my credit card. The interest rate would be closer to the borrowing costs of a large corporation with a B or BB investment rating from a major rating agency like Standard & Poor's, i.e., not considered investment grade, but not terrible either. But here's the good part. I was only on the hook for those upfront interest charges. If the investment in Wells Fargo stock didn't work out, i.e., if the stock traded down, even all the way down to zero, I didn't have to pay off the principal of the loan I took out to buy the stock. My only loss would be those upfront interest charges. On the other hand, if the stock went up, I would participate dollar for dollar in Wells's upside. My profits would be equal to the increase in Wells Fargo stock, less the interest charges for borrowing the money to buy the stock. I had to look at this again. Interest rates equivalent to those paid by many large corporations. No repayment obligation on the loan if things didn't work out. That sounded pretty good. My only question was, where do I sign up? Note, this was no different from a typical leaps analysis. The interest costs were high because they included the cost of the protection money. Also, for you sticklers, including the effective dividends does not materially change the basic point. So what happened? Pretty much everything that Berkowitz had predicted. California didn't fall into the ocean, and Wells Fargo earned almost $15 per share in 1994, and over $20 per share in 1995. By September 1994, the stock had more than doubled to $160 per share. As for the leaps, what's another word for home run? A quick word on warrants. If you liked leaps, in some ways warrants are even better. A warrant gives the holder the right to buy stock at a specified price for a set period of time. While similar to call options, warrants differ in two ways. First, warrants are issued by the underlying company. So 5-year warrants to buy IBM stock at $82 per share allow the holder to purchase stock directly from IBM at any time during the next 5 years at a price of $82. In contrast, listed call options represent contractual arrangements between investors to buy or sell a particular stock. The underlying company is not involved. The second difference between typical call options and warrants should be of more importance to you. At the time they are issued, warrants usually have a longer time to expiration than typical call options. Like leaps, warrants can extend for a period of years. Though leaps usually extend for no more than 2.5 years, the expiration date for newly issued warrants can be 5, 7, or even 10 years away. Some perpetual warrants, with no expiration date, have actually been issued. As with leaps, the investment merits of the underlying stock are the main basis for making a warrant investment. Given the benefits of leverage and protection offered by warrants over such an extended period of time, it is usually worth checking to see whether warrants have been issued by companies whose stocks appear attractive. Another quick word. Options and special situation investing. Warning. This section is for advanced students only, although compulsive gamblers are also welcome. The option markets can present special situation investors with an opportunity to make spectacular profits from a little-known market inefficiency. This is true even though for over two decades, elaborate computer models have been continually developed and refined to calculate the correct theoretical values for every conceivable type of option, including leaps and warrants. Given the amount of professional and academic firepower directed toward the study of options and other derivative securities, securities created to emulate or react to the movements of other securities, you might think that common sense and a pencil would be of little use. In reality, when it comes to investing in the options of companies undergoing extraordinary corporate change, special situation investors have a huge advantage over the high-powered quants, read, computer-wielding eggheads, or more accurately, rich computer-wielding eggheads. This is because, in many cases, option traders, including the quants, view stock prices as simply numbers, not as the prices of shares in actual businesses. In general, professionals and academics calculate an option's correct, or theoretical, price by first measuring the past price volatility of the underlying stock, a measure of how much the price of the stock has fluctuated. This volatility measure is then plugged into a formula that is probably some variant of the Black-Scholes model for valuing a call option. This is the formula used by most academics and professionals to value options. The formula takes into account the stock's price, the exercise price of the option, interest rates, and the time remaining until expiration, as well as the stock's volatility. The higher a stock's past volatility, the higher the option price. Often, however, option traders who use these formulas do not take into account extraordinary corporate transactions. The stocks of companies undergoing an imminent spin-off, corporate restructuring, or stock merger may move significantly as a result of these special transactions, not because historically their stocks have fluctuated in a certain way. Therefore, the options of companies undergoing extraordinary change may well be mispriced. It should be no surprise, then, that this is where your opportunity lies. Depending upon how large or how important a spin-off is relative to the parent company, the stocks of spin-offs and parent companies can move dramatically after a spin-off is completed. Since the date of distribution of spin-off shares is announced in advance, knowing this information along with some fundamental information about the underlying companies involved can give you a large edge over option traders who invest by the numbers. One strategy would be to buy options that expire several weeks to several months after a spin-off is consummated. In the period after the spin-off, the parent company's stock may make a dramatic move because investors had previously been holding back on purchasing the parent's stock until the divestiture of the unwanted business was completed. So too, the spin-off stock's price could be a source of surprise during this initial trading period simply because it is a new stock with no trading history and no underwriter to set an expected price range. The bottom line is that the options markets can be a profitable place to exploit your research efforts in the spin-off area. Specifically, you can apply both your knowledge of when a spin-off is scheduled to take place and your fundamental understanding of the underlying companies involved. Restructuring transactions and stock mergers can provide similar advantages to knowledgeable option investors. In restructuring situations, knowing the timing of crucial events in an ongoing program can help you choose the appropriate option expiration date for a call or put position. In many cases, the date of a significant distribution of cash or securities or the target date for the sale of assets can correspond to a significant price move in the underlying stock. In merger situations, where a portion of the acquisition price is paid with common stock, it is the closing date of the merger that can be the catalyst for extraordinary stock price moves. Shares of the acquiring company, into which your options on the target company become convertible once the merger is completed, are under all sorts of pressure before and immediately after the merger is finalized. First, in most cases, risk arbitrageurs start buying shares of the target company and simultaneously begin shorting shares of the acquirer almost immediately after a merger is announced. Only once the merger is completed is this source of selling pressure on the acquirer's stock usually relieved. Also, in the weeks immediately after the closing of a merger, those shareholders who had not already sold their shares when the merger was announced tend to sell the shares they received in the acquirer's company. This is usually because the original investment in the target company's shares was made for reasons specific to that company, reasons not applicable to the acquirer's shares. After this selling pressure subsides, the acquirer's stock can sometimes move up dramatically. This is most apt to take place when a large amount of new stock is issued in the merger relative to the amount of pre-deal shares the acquirer had outstanding. But enough theory. Now let's see a real-world example of how extraordinary corporate events can throw a wrench into the workings of the most sophisticated computer models. Case study: Marriott Corporation Options. The Marriott spin-off situation, discussed in Chapter 3, provides a good example of this phenomenon. As we heard, Marriott Corporation was splitting into two separate companies, a good Marriott, Marriott International, and a bad Marriott, Host Marriott. Marriott International was expected to have all of the valuable hotel management contracts, and Host Marriott was expected to hold all of the unsaleable real estate burdened with billions in debt. With almost 11 months prior warning, the split was scheduled to take place on September 30, 1993. In August of 1993, with Marriott Corporation stock trading at $27.75, I was able to purchase the October 1993 calls with an exercise price of $25 per share for a cost of $3.125. Since the third Friday in October fell on October 15th, and the spinoff was to be completed by September 30th, the stocks of both Marriott International and Host Marriott would be trading independently for at least 2 weeks before my calls expired. Usually, if a spinoff takes place before an option expires, upon exercise, the option holder is entitled to receive shares in both the parent company and the spinoff as if he had owned stock on the spinoff date. In this particular case, this meant that if I exercised my calls when they expired in the middle of October, I would receive one share of Marriott International and one share of Host Marriott in exchange for the exercise price of $25. The trick was that the price I paid for my options didn't take into account the fact that a spinoff was being consummated several weeks before their expiration. Both stocks, the parent and the spinoff, would be trading independently before my options expired. Investors who had been waiting to purchase the good Marriott, Marriott International, without taking on the risks of all that debt and unsellable real estate, would finally be able to buy the stock in the first 2 weeks of October. This could mean a significant price move during the new stock's first weeks of trading. Further, the valuation of the bad Marriott, Host Marriott, was also in question. Host Marriott had over $2.5 billion of debt and little more than 100 million shares outstanding. Therefore, the difference between a stock price of $3 per share for Host Marriott and a price of $6 per share was not as large as it might have appeared. A $3 share price would mean a total market capitalization, the total market value of debt plus stock, of $2.8 billion, and a $6 stock price would translate into a total market capitalization for the company of $3.1 billion. A valuation differential of only 10%, rather than the apparent 100% disparity. In short, the first 2 weeks of October were going to be a very active time for the stocks of both Host Marriott and Marriott International. What happened? Well, approximately a month after my initial purchase of the options, just days before the September 30th spinoff date, the stock of Marriott Corporation had moved up to $28.50, resulting in a price for the October 25th calls of $3.625. However, by October 15th, the date my options expired, a dramatic change had taken place. Host Marriott stock was trading at $6.75. The stock of Marriott International traded up to $26 per share. Since my options gave me the right to buy one share of both stocks for a combined price of $25, my options had skyrocketed to $7.75. This was because the value of one share of Marriott International at $26 plus one share of Host Marriott at $6.75 equaled a combined value of $32.75, which I had the right to buy at $25. The rise in the October 30th calls was even more dramatic. These calls, which could have been purchased for 25 cents on September 23rd, were worth $2.75 upon expiration just 3 weeks later. There is no way that plugging past price volatilities into a computer program could have predicted this dramatic move in the options of Marriott Corporation. See how a little work and a little knowledge can pay off? Isn't it nice to know that every now and again, life is fair? A quick summary and a free offer. 1. Stub stocks. There is almost no other area of the stock market where research and careful analysis can be rewarded as quickly and as generously. 2. Leaps. There is almost no other area of the stock market, with the possible exception of stub stocks, where research and careful analysis can be rewarded as quickly and as generously. 3. Warrants and special situation option investing. There is almost no other area of the stock market, with the possible exception of stub stocks and leaps, where research and careful analysis can be rewarded as quickly and as generously. Free offer! Free! Free! This coupon entitles the bearer to one free set of Ginsu knives. Coupon must be accompanied by 5 trade confirmations of now worthless stub stocks, leaps, warrants, or options. This offer is void and prohibited. Offer expires the third Friday of each month. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for delivery, then wait some more. Free! Free! Chapter 7. Seeing the Trees Through the Forest. So, am I that crazy cop, the one whose partner is always getting killed? You know, I keep making money investing in all of these special corporate situations, while you end up in a fetal position wearing an old pair of feety pajamas? Well, the truth is, I could be that cop. Whether I am or not is largely up to you. While it's true that you can be a stock market genius, there's no guarantee that you will be. Like the acquisition of any new skill, becoming a good investor can take both time and practice. By leading you to investment areas where the odds are stacked in your favor, I've tried to give you a big head start, but you still have to use good judgment. If you're not already an experienced stock market investor, you might start off investing only a small portion of your assets in these special corporate situations. As your experience and knowledge expand, you may feel confident enough to commit a larger share of your resources. There are other ways you can avoid playing the role of the dead partner. Frankly, I'm not going to be around to avenge your death in Act 3. So you're going to have to learn how to look out for yourself. One way to do this is to pay attention to the makeup of your portfolio. For instance, while a portfolio of 5 or 6 different spin-offs probably makes sense, a portfolio made up solely of 5 or 6 different leaps probably doesn't. Similarly, unless you're an expert in the field, concentrating all or most of your investments in any one industry is generally unwise. Further, taking on lots of margin debt can force you to sell out your positions at just the wrong time. Only investors with substantial experience should borrow more than modest amounts against their investment portfolio. but all of this is just common sense. If you're short on common sense when it comes to investments, and you aren't willing to put in the time to get some, maybe managing your